Well, thank you. So let me just say for the record, it's the FCIC, and we're talking to William Cohan. And do you pronounce it Cohan?
Cohan.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sure you get all versions.
I get that asset a lot, yeah.
Right. And anyway, it's myself, Matthew Cooper, and Adam Paul. Well, thanks for talking to us. We're such fans of yours that we know this is not the first time we've talked to you, and it's probably more like the fifth. But we keep coming back for more. And, you know, I know my colleague Tom Krebs had talked to you some time ago in some detail about Bayer and your, you know, intimate familiarity with its decline. But we wanted today, if that's possible, to talk a little bit more broadly about the financial crisis and mm-hmm. get your thoughts on it in a larger scope. So let me just start out with a general question I've asked a lot of people, which is, what do you see as the causes of the financial crisis?
I mean, to me, it gets back to, frankly, and this comes from, you know, an intimate 17-year knowledge of Wall Street. And so it gets back, in my view, very simply, to the incentives that currently exist on Wall Street that govern the behavior of the people who work there. And it's very simple in my mind. It's, you know, human beings do what they're rewarded to do. And in this crisis, as, by the way, this is just the most recent of, you know, four or five that we've had, you know, in my professional lifetime, like the last 20-plus years, really acute financial crises that I think have sprung from a very fundamental change in the way Wall Street has organized itself. Once upon a time, and I've said this many times, but once upon a time there were, Wall Street was a series of small, basically undercapitalized private partnerships, which were made up of, you know, the capital from which came from individual partners' pockets that they were required to, you know, invest in the company to become a partner, by and large, and that because of the way the partnerships were organized, made them in effect have their entire net worth on the line for all decisions that were made at the firm and all losses that were suffered by the firm, and it was a very precarious, you know, situation because they were undercapitalized by and large, and but they were also very highly attuned to the business that was being done. So that's why these firms started out being A, relatively small, and B, focused on business that didn't require a lot of capital, M&A advice, underwriting debt and equity securities, which by and large don't require capital unless something goes wrong, and most of the time things didn't go wrong. And so that it became sort of like a fee business, which didn't require very much capital. But all of that began to change in 1970 when DLJ announced to the world that it was going public and New York Stock Exchange rules had to be changed, and then, you know, Merrill Lynch came next, and then, you know, the flood of, so that now we have, by 2010, 40 years later, virtually every major and not so major Wall Street firm is a public company which uses other people's capital now, their creditors' capital, their shareholders' capital, to make huge bets on, you know, using that money. And by the way these corporations are now structured, the liabilities for people's behavior are now borne by the corporation, not by them individually. And so behaviors have changed dramatically on Wall Street. And so when I was a banker for 17 years, even though I was an M&A banker and never risked any capital, the only thing that my bosses cared about was me generating more and more M&A revenue. And whether there was any cost to that revenue or any liabilities associated with that revenue didn't really matter to them. I mean, we all tried to do the right thing, but if you then, you know, translate that behavior and that mentality into the trading side of the business, the underwriting side of the business, parts of the business where real capital was committed, you can see that very quickly this whole incredible battleship that is Wall Street was motivated by only one thing, and that was to get as big a bonus as they possibly could year in and year out by generating the thing that they were rewarded for, which was generating revenue based on the product or area that they were working in. So if you were a, you know, mortgage-backed security salesman, the only thing that mattered to you was selling more and more mortgage-backed securities, regardless of whether what you were packaging up and selling was of good quality or bad quality, good loans, bad loans, good mortgages, bad mortgages. It didn't matter. All that mattered was generating that fee income so that you could then, at the end of the year, point to your boss and say, look what I generated, and I want, you know, a big bonus as a result. And by the way, that's the system that worked for many, many years. There was financial innovation. This is a great. The last 40 years have been an extraordinary period of financial innovation on Wall Street, which, you know, its defenders will argue, you know, lowered the cost of capital to businesses through, say, for instance, making money available through junk bonds, or through homeowners through lowering mortgage rates, or, you know, credit and making credit available to the masses through credit cards and cars available through auto loans and things like that. All of these things, which were, you know, huge innovations on Wall Street because of the securitization of these streams of capital, of these cash flows that were turned into investments and sold off as investors to investors around the world. So there was a period of great innovation, but a consequence of the great innovation was that, you know, these Wall Street bankers and traders had new products to trade and to sell, and they were only motivated by one thing, which was to generate the revenue based on selling these products and services so they could get a big bonus. And we, as we all know, and as I experienced firsthand, and found it quite extraordinary, by the way, was the amount of money that people were paid on Wall Street and continue to be paid for what they do. And I've never understood the pay structure. And there's nothing, by the way, in any of the 2,200 pages of law that has now just been passed that goes to changing this pay structure or in any way making the people financially responsible for the products and services they're selling. Which leads me to conclude that we're just, you know, biding our time until there's another crisis of a very different nature, but driven by the same behaviors that we've just experienced, you know, in this last go-round that you're studying, and the numerous times before that no one is studying. But you know, there was a study after the '87 crash, and there was a big, you know, the Brady Commission, and there was a big, big volume published, but. You know, and people swore they would never happen again, and yet we now know that it's happened repeatedly. And to me, it gets back to this one simple common denominator, which is what motivates people. Human nature, to me, is very, very simple. People do what they're rewarded to do, and on Wall Street, they're rewarded extremely well to generate revenue. And people with, you know, it's not like, paying Alex Rodriguez, $20 million a year to, you know, perform for the New York Yankees, I mean, or LeBron James. I mean, these people have extraordinary talent, unique talent, and they are rewarded extraordinarily well in our free market society. But on Wall Street, believe it or not, people are more basically good soldiers. They do what they're rewarded to do. There are very few people who have extraordinary talent. And the people with extraordinary talent on Wall Street, generally move on to form their own firms or their own hedge funds, their own private equity firms, or their own in investment banking businesses and get paid extraordinarily well as a result. But by and large, there's no other place on the face of the earth where people who are sort of good soldiers, who are smart but not extraordinary, can go and make the kind of money that they can now make on Wall Street. And frankly, I was living proof of that. You know, I was not an extraordinary M&A guy by any stretch of the imagination, but I was paid more than I had any right to be paid. And, you know, I wasn't complaining. That's a long-winded answer.
I appreciate that. Let me say we're joined
By Gary Cohen, no relation, different letter.
Okay. Hi, Gary.
Hi. No. When one of the your comments are beginning to become very, very familiar. Many other people have made the same point, and you know, that's sort of the dirty little secret that not too many people seem to talk about, or at least people with the ability to do anything about it.
No, I agree with that.
Yeah, it's a it's an interesting set of comments, and the whole, you know, the Minsky theory of capitalism and how it needs a countervailing thought is something which has been mentioned to us. Do you, but getting back to what we're doing, have you given any thought to what the commission, and I apologize if I'm being repetitive as to what Matt may have asked, have you given any thought to areas that you think that the FCIC really ought to be investigating, that insofar as if you have been following anything that we've been mm-hmm. doing, which I don't, you know, don't suspect you have very closely.
I haven't.
We ought to be looking at that. Maybe we haven't yet. And we've got about 4 months left before we have to hand over this magnum opus.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we do have some staff time and availability of new investigations. I'm just wondering if there's anything that you have in at the top of your head that if you had resources you'd like to have us look at.
Well, I mean, I think you've done a remarkably good job in investigating the key aspects of the causes, you know, the acute causes of the crisis, you know whether it was, you know, the collateral calls by Goldman against AIG and others, or, you know, the short-term nature of the financing on Wall Street, you know, the old borrowing short and lending long. You know, I don't, you know, to this point that I was making earlier, I haven't seen anybody really get to the bottom of the pay structure on Wall Street, and what really motivates people to do what they have done in the past and will do in the future if it's not changed. You know, I think a session, you know, drilling down into this pay structure, this reliance on revenue, you know, the fact that, you know, between 50% and 60% of every dollar of revenue is paid out in the form of compensation and benefits. And I note with interest that, you know, Goldman in the last quarter, you know, is trying to, I think, rejigger that percentage. It's sort of low in the low 40s now. Although I noted that Lazard yesterday, you know, was up over 60%. So, you know, this thing is a very, very hard thing to change. And although I think if I were, you know, the Wall Street czar for a day, I would change it, you know, immediately. I mean, if you think about it, the revenue that is generated at these firms is the property of the shareholders. I mean, if you're going to have this corporate structure where there are shareholders and creditors as opposed to the partners, since it's not owned by the partners anymore, it's owned by the shareholders, that revenue belongs to the shareholders. But when you've got this crazy system where 50 to 60 percent, or even 40 to 50 percent of every dollar of revenue generated is paid out in the form of compensation and and benefits to the people who work there, I mean, that is just, first of all, it's a variable cost. I mean, one of the ways that Goldman showed the kind of profit it did in the second quarter, despite the write-offs, was by, you know, lowering its compensation expense, which is, you know, very easy to do. Lloyd Blankfein can do that, you know, automatically in a second. And so this revenue that is generated belongs to the shareholders but doesn't really get to them. And that's one major problem. The other major problem being that the motivation of people who's only, you know, why else go to Wall Street but to make a lot of money, I just think is the priorities are all wrong. And why should we be rewarding? I mean, a fundamental question, why should we be rewarding people on Wall Street to this extent for what they do when I think as a society, you know, we would... Shouldn't we be rewarding people who, like, educate our children or heal our people when they're sick or, you know, things that... Or investigate financial crises? I mean, why is it that the people who perpetrate these crises on us, and they're so all-encompassing now because of the tentacles that are everywhere, we haven't rejiggered the compensation system. And so a session that really focused on that would really... really get to the heart of the matter, and you know, as I was just saying, obviously never mentioned once during the whole tortuous process that resulted in the Dodd-Frank bill law. There's nothing in there that really goes to this. You know, Ken Feinberg, you know, was roundly criticized every time he tried to examine this, and you know, quickly, you know, why did these guys get out of the TARP as quickly as they did? Well, some would say because they didn't need the money in the first place, but the clear reason is they didn't want to be have Ken Feinberg in their shorts, you know, trying to tell them what they could do about how much they could pay themselves.
There is that. So you think that we should be looking at a compensation study or investigation of some type?
Absolutely, and you know, it's one thing because when these partnerships were these small private partnerships, they paid out, you know, at Lazard they paid out 90% of each year's pre-tax income in payments to the partners and kept 10% back. At Goldman, you know, they kept a lot more back, and actually there were times before Goldman was a public company. Where partners, because Goldman was so often in and out of trouble, got very little compensation, and in fact their capital accounts got docked, and it wasn't particularly lucrative to be a Goldman partner. We changed from that to this, you know, platinum ring, this golden ring, this incredible, you know, compensation machine, and it's all because of the transformation from private partnerships to public companies. Not that Goldman wasn't profitable, and not that, as a relative matter, Goldman partners did better than, you know, Wall Street partners have always done better than, you know, teachers or, you know, engineers or something, but it really just, you know, got way, way out of control. And again, it's not... going, hasn't changed one iota. In fact, there's the latest rash of stories about how it's all picking up again, and people are fighting over, you know, to pay people to come work to their firms. You know, there's the fight for talent that's now going on again, which will inevitably lead to another incident like this.
Because just to hone in on it, because the compensation structure encourages excessive risk taking.
Yes, with other people's money,
right.
With no corresponding accounting, no way to hold people accountable for their behavior, i.e., you know, as Dodd said back in the first April 2008 hearing, Bear Stearns hearing, that very first one, he said, you know, privatized the reward and socialized the risk. That's one of the smartest things he said. And he's absolutely right, and that's why, you know, I've tried a few times. You know, I don't mention it much anymore. But what I call, there's the Volcker rule. I say the Cohen rule, which is that they should put at the bottom of the capital structure, below the equity, that they should create a new class of securities in these Wall Street firms, because you can't make them into partnerships again. A new class of security that represents the net worth of like the top 100 people at these firms, the people who are making decisions, the people who are deciding where capital is to be invested, the people who are overseeing the risk that is being taken, that represents their net worth, and the first thing, and is actually tied legally to their net worth, and so that the first thing that disappears if things start going badly is these people's net worth, like it used to be when they're private partnerships. And that would get them much more highly focused on the risks that they're taking. Not just sort of like, you know, have a passing interest like Jimmy Cain seemed to have, because he'd already taken out $400 million and socked it away, and so, you know, he's playing with the house's money on the other billion, and if he lost, you know, so he could go play golf and play bridge instead of focusing on the risks that Bear Stearns was taking. And same thing with Fald. I mean, whether he's taken out $400 or $500 million and socked it away, yeah, the other billion that he has, you know, with the house's money. I mean, it's actually very similar an idea to what Goldman actually still does, which is they pay, without having the corresponding liabilities, but at least they motivate in part the top 300 or 400 people at the firm. It's sort of, and a very interesting session would be, you know, having, you know, Blankfein or whoever explain the partner MD concept, which is that these 300 or 400 people at Goldman get paid out of the pre-tax income of the firm, not based on revenue like everybody else at the firm. And I think this is what motivated, in my view, this is what motivated Goldman to take steps that nobody else took, as famously we now know, in December of 2006 when they decided to get short the mortgage market.
Because they had more skin in the game.
Well, it's not the same as them having their liabilities at risk, which is what I propose. But at least they knew that these top 300 or 400 guys weren't going to, if they had a loss, they weren't, for the year, they weren't going to get paid anything. So, you know, they were much more attuned. Since it wasn't a revenue driver that decided their compensation, it was a net pre-tax income driver, they were much more attuned to the risks on the expense side that the firm was taking, which is why I think they are a devoted mark-to-market firm, you know, despite the risks that it caused everybody else in the market who are less devoted to that. But I think that's why Goldman, you know, behaves the way it does. And nobody else on Wall Street does this. Nobody.
That's interesting. Who, Bill, do you know any serious compensation experts? I know Alan Johnston. Do you know anybody who can actually speak to this issue, who would be familiar enough with the various compensation programs on Wall Street that could make some intelligent observations about it? Besides you, of course.
Yes. There are people like him. I think there's these... You know, three amigos at Harvard Law School. What's his name? Debchuk.
Yeah, I know. I saw the Debchuk. He's written, articles about how out of whack economically the Wall Street firms have become.
Yeah, and he studied it. They did that study that came out in like November of last year or something.
Yeah, I think it's Lucian Bebchuk.
And friends. He's a guy who could speak very intelligently to it, but I mean, you know, you could get people like who've seen it change so dramatically. You could get people like Felix Roatan, who's still kicking around. People like Greenhill. People who have seen it really evolve and change and move away. You could even get the William Donaldson or Jen Rett, I mean, or Lufkin. I mean, the guys who started the whole damn thing. who could talk about, you know, Donaldson, who's you know, the former commissioner of the SEC. So, I mean, these people understand.
That's an interesting,
exactly
interesting,
what's happened here.
Interesting approach.
Did you, I forgot the exact timing of Last Tycoons, but, I mean, did you see, I mean, Lazard went public pretty late, right?
They were the last firm to go public in May of 2005. And I wrote about that in the book, which was published in April 2007.
And so did you see a more cultural shift towards more risk-taking when they switched? Or?
Well, Lazard has a very different business plan. And I've, in fact, written that if more firms stayed like Lazard, this crisis never would have happened either. See, Lazard has decided to stick, you know, once upon a time, all, you know, the big firms, quote-unquote, the big firms were all small and all the same size, and they all looked like Lazard. In other words, at one point, Goldman, Morgan Stanley, and Lazard were all the same size. They all had like 200 people. They all did M&A advisory work and some principal investing work and some debt and equity underwriting work. And this wasn't so long ago. This was in like you know, the early 70s. And then you know, things just changed, you know, dramatically, as I've discussed. Lazard stayed the same. I mean, it grew. It's now like 3,000 people. Well, Goldman's what, 35,000 people. So, you know, and Morgan Stanley's even more, I think. So. And they just got into these very, very different businesses, whereas you know, they made the decision that they were going to get bigger and be global and you know, provide all this financing and take all this risk, whereas Lazard just sort of stuck to providing M&A. In fact, they the public company that was you know, made. The public company that they created completely took out their capital markets business and put it into a separate company. That's not even part of the public company at the moment.
Well, is that part of the shift? And I don't know how long it's taken for it to happen, but there's some talk about the shift from the M&A and relationship business to the trading business and the ascendancy of traders at the top of all of the Wall Street firms, as opposed to M&A and relationship bankers that may have prevailed in the 70s or, you know, early 80s. I don't know whether that's true across the board or not.
Well, the truth is that the, you know, the ascendancy, the jujitsu between traders and bankers is, you know, been going on since the 70s. In some phases of time, the bankers are in ascendancy. In some phases, the traders are in ascendancy. I think now you're going to get into a time where sort of like the banker types, or more interestingly, sort of these third type of executives who are sort of like consultant types, who are sort of polymaths, who are neither bankers nor traders, like the guy at Morgan Stanley. I mean, you've just got this guy, or the guy at B of A, I mean, who's, you know, sort of like a professional manager as opposed to any particular skill. I mean, these companies have gotten so big that they're all about management now. I mean, I think that, you know, the chances of another trader being, I wish Gary Cohn at Goldman Sachs, you know, the best of luck, but I don't think his chances are very high anymore that he's going to be leading that firm after Blankfein departs. But I mean, you know, I think that you know, the ascendancy of traders, and especially, and you see its sort of purest embodiment in Goldman, you know, which became, you know, the perfect machine, the perfectly designed machine for, you know, the lax regulation that has existed in the last 25 years and the ability to use other people's money to take asynchronous bets, to make asynchronous bets. I mean, Goldman is the most perfectly tuned machine, or was, to take advantage of that environment. And it evolved into that, and, you know, they got the best, constantly got the best people, and they evolved more and more into a firm that took these huge calculated risks with other people's money, and, you know, figured out a way to do it extremely profitably, and was clever enough to back off of it or to change directions nimbly, unlike every other firm on Wall Street who couldn't do that, who wasn't structured and set up, or didn't have the capability or the intelligence, or didn't you know. One thing Goldman does extremely well is it communicates extremely well, and some people have accused it of using information from one part of the firm to trade, you know, client information to trade on, but this ability to communicate so well among each other and their ability to make the risk people every bit as important, I mean, the people who manage the risk every bit as important as the people who generate, you know, the M&A revenue and the trading revenue. No other firm on Wall Street does that, and that worked extremely well to their advantage in a time when there was lax regulation, and it was just laissez-faire, and try to make as much money as you possibly could any way you could. I don't think, ironically, they're as well set up now for this new environment we're in, even though we're not quite sure what this new environment really is going to mean.
Did you see the article today? And I think it was in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. It could have been the New York Times. I read it early this morning about how Goldman now has moved a lot of their activities from one part of the firm to the money management part of the firm, which allows them to evade some of the evade is a bad word, to comply with the regulations by not having that apply to the main part of the firm. And
the securities part of the firm?
Yeah. It was interesting how they got it that quickly. A lot of people haven't finished reading the law yet, and they're already getting around it, apparently. they're bright guys.
Yes, they are. Well, and they're bright guys, and they have very devoted lawyers, very bright lawyers. So.
They do. Anyway, I didn't read that article more carefully. I read it online, I think. Don't let me stop you. I have a meeting with the chair. But is there anything that you learned since your last public pronouncements on the crisis that you think is sort of new information? That's come to you, or anything that if you were writing now, what you would write about?
Well, I think the last thing that I had had realized or uncovered or felt strongly about was what I think you guys hit on in your last hearing, which was this role of the collateral calls and the the agreements that Goldman was really pushing, and the effect that it had on Bear Stearns and that it had on AIG and and all the other people who could make collateral calls as well, and this the way they marked the securities to market. I think that there still remains a huge structural problem. Alan Schwartz, tells me that I make too much of this because, this is the very definition of banking, but this whole idea of, borrowing short and lending long, maybe that is banking, but that creates, inherent structural problems anytime confidence goes up the wazoo. So if people lose confidence, then you can't get this short-term funding that is the lifeblood of what banking is. So I'm not sure you can ever change it. I think at least now we're to a point where securities firms basically by and large no longer exist, and so there are no firms that are wholly dependent. I mean, the reason, as we all know, that Bear Stearns and Lehman and Merrill, collapsed is because they couldn't get short-term funding from the market. Now, at least, they can go to the Fed because they're bank holding companies, and so they can do that. And I guess so that acute loss of confidence. When there's an acute loss of confidence, I guess now. I mean, we'll see. But I guess now there's a way for these firms to still get the capital they need to operate on a daily basis.
Yeah,
so that is that's a huge structural problem that, as I say, Alan Schwartz says to me, is the very definition of banking, and so you'll never, ever, how can you have banks and change that? And, an interesting argument.
Well, I think that's the point that people made about adequacy of capital, number one, and number two, to have a backstop lender of last resort, you know, the Fed, and being able to go to the Fed window. I guess that's how you deal with, that's how you cut off market panic by making the market understand there is a source of capital at the last, you know, as the last resort, but also you need the additional capital in the entity.
Yes, this, but
you know, all of the banks appear to have met the regulatory capital requirements. You know, and
yep.
So who knows?
But well, by implication, therefore, you'll never get rid of the too big to fail. You'll never get people to, if they think that they're always can go to the Fed. I mean, the whole, you know, Darwinian, you know, the belief, you know, Friedman, whatever it is, the Darwinian view that, you know, let the market decide, which we threw out the window this go round, is still you know, present. It's still thrown out because, you know, there's always this perceived or likely safety net that's going to be there. I mean, if you can always go to the Fed window, that means that when push comes to shove and the shit hits the fan, the Fed's going to step up again, despite, you know, all the stuff that's in that new legislation. I mean, and therefore, because of the court getting into bringing it all back to where we started, because of the way Wall Street compensates itself, you're not going to get people who are finely attuned, unless you go with the Cohen rule, you're not going to get people who are finely attuned to the risks they're taking.
Well, I think it. I think Greenspan actually said if they're too big to fail, they're too big. Although that quote hasn't been played up very much. You know, and as long as you know, and you do need to go to the Fed rule, Fed window, you do need assets. So there is that limitation. But you're right. I mean, Warren Buffett, in front of our in the interview that we had with him, and in front of our commission, proposed a rule which is which was somewhat similar to what you said. You know, he was in favor of charging the senior management and the board of directors multiples of what they receive from the firm if indeed the firms failed and people lost money in a bankruptcy or something similar, even to the point he made the point somewhat jokingly. He said, including their wives. And I think he probably meant their spouses to be politically
correct.
Or their significant others.
Yes, yeah.
But he did make that point.
Well, I agree with him there.
Right.
This whole level of accountability that used to exist when it was their own net worth on the line is completely lost. I mean, how else can you explain, you know, that Jimmy Cain, you know, off playing golf and bridge and
right.
Fold, you know, hold up on the 31st floor, you know, behind closed doors?
Yeah,
right. And on this moral hazard question, some folks have said, you know, the government shouldn't have helped J.P. Morgan buy Bear. Others have said they should have stepped in even more aggressively to save Lehman. I mean, where do you stand on that whole sequence of events?
Well, if you look back, I think the first column I wrote at the beginning of the year for the New York Times was basically, you know, now having thought about it at that point for close to 2 years, I think that they should just let Bear fail. I mean, I know why they didn't at the time, and it makes perfect sense, and I don't second guess that, but now in retrospect, I think had they let Bear fail, in other words, just let the market decide whether Bear could have opened again for business on March 16th or whatever it was. I think, and it wouldn't have opened for business. It would have failed. I mean, if you're Dick Fuld, would you have dithered for 6 months?
No.
No. Or John Thain? No. You would have immediately said, oh, my God, I'm just a bigger version of Bear Stearns. I got the same products. I got the same structure. I have the same vulnerability. I'm going to do immediately what I need to do to solve this, which in Lehman's case would have been, you know, selling it to whomever, and you know, Merrill's. You know, I think that an artificial, even though they were well-meaning, and I completely understand why they did it. You know, the market is a very powerful force, and it sends very powerful messages. And that message was warped by the actions of the government at that time. And I actually think that had they let Bear fail, Lehman would have taken the steps to save itself. Or if it couldn't, it would have gone too. I mean, and that would have been okay. I mean, I still think that people say, well, you know, I don't understand, frankly, when they say this, because I can't really see what the negative repercussions have been, except for the, you know, the scary times when things froze up. But I mean, I think that having Lehman fail was exactly the message that needed to be sent. That was exactly what needed to happen. And if you look, because we cannot reward, I mean, basically we had set up a system where the markets were failing, David Einhorn had it right. I mean, Lehman was, you know, horribly structured. We now know from the Veloukis report that it was being, I think, duplicitous in the way it was reporting to shareholders and creditors information. Its accounting was screwed up, and I think we cannot reward, the market can't reward that kind of behavior, and that's what was happening. So I think the best thing was that the market rendered this harsh judgment against the firm. By you know, if you look at it now in the aftermath 2 years later, I would say that, you know, most people who worked at Lehman have gotten new jobs. You know, you've had the people who were the investors in Lehman have suffered dramatically, and guess what? They should. That's the nature of the system. I mean, if it's working properly, you can't reward
right.
people who take those kind of risks without doing their homework, without, you know, who I mean, if there was criminal behavior, the people should be held criminally liable, which I know it hasn't happened yet, but maybe will. And I think that things got really scary, not when Lehman failed, which was, you know, September 15th or whatever, but got really, really scary, I think we'll all agree, is when Congress didn't vote the TARP money the first time.
Right.
That's when things really seemed to fall off a cliff. So, I actually think that we could have all been saved a lot of the pain that we experienced in the fall of 2008 had they let Bear fail the first time. And that was the first time that the government had ever stepped in to save a securities firm. And I understand why they did it. I've had conversations with all the people who were involved in doing it. I understand their point of view. I just think, and I probably would have done the same thing had I been in their place. Because it would have been awfully hard not to, especially if you thought that that was going to be the end of it.
Right.
And it seemed like it was for a while. But in retrospect, now 2+ years, I think what historians will decide is that they should have, you know, let it go.
That makes sense. And forgive me, did you come to a conclusion in House of Cards about whether Jamie Dimon would really have walked away without the federal assistance? I mean, was he just bluffing a good game to get the money, or would he, in fact, if they didn't provide the money, he might still have fought Bear?
You know what? I think that that they were genuine in saying they didn't. I don't think they wanted it that much, frankly.
Yeah.
I think that's what it comes down to. I think that, and look at what they've kept. I mean, virtually nothing.
Right.
They wanted that new building next
right.
door to their little corporate, you know, area over there.
Right.
Because we all know they were going to move downtown. So, or at least their investment bank. So that's what they wanted, and they got that for a song. So that's the main thing they wanted. I think there was, you know, some oil and gas trading businesses that they wanted, but, you know, come on, they could have easily created that themselves.
That
you know, beyond sense. That, what if they,
what was
the clearing business, you know, and some brokers. So,
yeah, I hear
so my view is that, you know, for a price, they would buy, I think their negotiations were typical kind of Wall Street negotiations. Oh, yeah, 8 to 12, they quickly realize there's nobody else and that the company is desperate. So, I mean, I think what is clear throughout this is that Jamie Dimon took advantage of his competitors.
Yeah.
Both in calling for more collateral or squeezing them from a liquidity line, and in the case of both WaMu and Bear Stearns, taking advantage in the negotiations. I mean, that's what people do.
I hear you. Well, thank you. You've been very kind to sit with us again on this. I appreciate it.
You're more than welcome.
You know, if you think of other areas we should investigate, what you would most like to see if you had subpoena power, or anything like that, please, you know, give
me. Well, I'll add one more thing, since you mentioned if I had subpoena power.
Yes.
I'm still dying to know who bought, and I wrote about this in the book, who bought those short-dated puts in March of 2008? Who bought those short-dated puts that Bear would fail when Bear was trading at $75 a share? And people bet millions of dollars that in 8 days, Bear Stearns would go out of business.
Right.
And they were right.
And Kane,
but who bets millions of dollars?
And Kane and others thought they were brought down by this attack of the shorts, right?
Well, I don't believe that.
Right.
I don't believe that, but I am, you know, very curious as to who was buying those short-dated puts and whether, see, there is a theory that people, hedge funds, who were prime brokerage clients of Bear Stearns, were pulling their money out of Bear Stearns because they had bought, you know, because they thought there might be risk. Okay, good decision, right? But they had also bought short-dated puts and then put out the word in the market that, you know, they pulled their money out of Bear, you know, the Bear prime brokerage, because they didn't think they could make, you know, weren't going to be around or had risk attached to it. So at the same time, and so they let the word, you know, go out at the same time that they bought these short-dated puts. So it's a sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's sort of what, like, the guy did when he asked Goldman Sachs to novate that trade with Bear Stearns that I also wrote about at the beginning of the book.
Right.
The guy from Kyle, whatever his name is, from Dallas, you know, and
Kyle Bass,
thank you.
Yeah.
He asked them to novate that trade.
Right.
And then when Goldman didn't immediately do it for good and valid reasons, he let the word go out into the market that Goldman wouldn't novate the trade immediately, which added to, you know, the rumor mill. The fact that if they agreed to do it the next morning, you know, the damage had already been done. If Kyle Bass also had those short-dated puts, well, to me, that's pretty damn interesting.
Yeah.
If I had subpoena power, that's what I'd like to know.
So you're, and I realize it's speculation, but you think, so you, if you were focusing on who might have done the short-dated puts, you'd look at
hedge fund guys.
Yeah, and in particular,
well, Kyle, that would be one. He benefited. He was one of the few. He and John Paulson were the two people I know of who benefited from this thing. Goldman benefited too. So you'd ask yourself, you know, we know that Goldman shorted Bear, you know, after the hedge funds failed, which I guess made sense. But was Goldman?
That's the Spectre stuff in 07, you mean? Or?
If you go back to the, you know, some of the documents that the Levin Committee unearthed, which, you know, I thank them every day for that. After the Bear Stearns hedge funds failed in July of 07, it was revealed that the same guys who had put the big short on,
yeah,
at Goldman, you know, Birnbaum and Company,
yeah,
beginning in December 2006, is part of that overall trade, you know, which ebbed and flowed. It's very clear that it wasn't linear.
Right.
It ebbed and flowed, but after the hedge funds failed, they started shorting their stock and a bunch of the stock of companies that were involved in the mortgage market. And that, there was a document about that, which, you know, makes sense in the overall context of what was happening at that time. The real question is, were they shorting before then? In other words, were they You know, because as I wrote in the book, with you know the whole collateral calls against the Bear Stearns hedge fund, the lowering of the marks. If they were lowering the marks and shorting Bear at the same time, i.e., earlier back in February, March, April of 2007, that would be sort of interesting to know.
Right, and just to clarify, in the context of the crisis. I mean, leaving aside the question of who got rich off various trades, in the context of the crisis, it's important because those moves help bring down Bear.
Yes, well, there's
right.
no question.
I mean, that's what does it.
Oh, there's no, in my view, I mean, I may be way out there. I know I'm not alone in this, but
I just want to solicit your view.
Yeah, the first order of you know mistake was that the Bear Stearns hedge funds made this huge bet that they did not disclose to their investors about on the mortgage market. In other words, when the ABX index fell in February of 2007, you know they viewed it as a buying opportunity. So
right.
they were wrong. So they were very bad investors. Okay, but then it got exacerbated many times over. I mean, their end was exacerbated by Goldman's marks in April of 2007 when they decided to and there's that famous memo from their chief risk officer where he says, you know, we're going to lower the marks and there's going to be repercussions in the market. Well, within days, there were these huge repercussions at the Bear hedge fund, which I lay out in the book.
Right.
And then Bear made the Bear executive committee, the Bear management committee, made the very fateful decision to become the repo lender to the hedge fund. Bear's exposure
right.
to the hedge fund was something like $40 or $45 million as an equity investor, which was, you know, bupkis, if I may use that word.
Right.
So if they lost $45 million, that'd be no big deal. But in June of 2007, Bear decided, with Jimmy apparently being the lone dissenter, that they needed, for reputational purposes, to take out the repo lenders to the hedge fund. So Bear's exposure went from $45 million. To $1.5 billion, and that's what brought down Bear.
Right.
So you know, there's a linkage one to the other over those months. You know, again, if the hedge fund guys had not bet so much on the mortgage market, if Bear wasn't so heavily reliant itself on the overnight repo market to finance itself. Then you know it could have withstood all of these things, but
the combination of their bad decision, Bear's bad decisions,
the structural flaws in the industry, the fact that after the hedge funds collapsed, Bear was unable to get financing other than in the repo market.
Right.
Right. You know, it made their collapse, especially, and then when you get the rumor mill going. I mean, the question that is unanswered and may never be answered. You know, were there very, very, very smart hedge fund people? You know, who figured it all out and began to take action, i.e., by shorting, buying short dated puts. By taking their money out of Bear, that exacerbated the whole thing. Was it just a trade that worked out extraordinarily well, or was it something else?
Right, and you think in the documents of those hedge funds, the answer might be
or the trading. The SEC was supposedly looking at this, and if I'm not mistaken, I believe all these trades could easily. Be looked at, you know, for this period of time. I mean, who bought those puts on the CBOE or whatever? Those records are easily available, but they've never been, you know. Supposedly the SEC was looking at them, but you know, I asked for the SEC for them, and they told me I couldn't have them. And they'd be easily knowable, easily.
Yeah. Well, let me let me see if we can take a look at that, and I may come back to you if that's okay for what time period to look at. And
sure.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. You've been very generous with your time here, and I appreciate it.